The season of mists and mellow fruitfulness has arrived, and tomatoes are fruit. Who better to ask about using the disappearing tomatoes of autumn and creating a Sunday brunch with them than Lucy Corrie, award-winning food writer, author of Home-Cooked Seasonal Recipes for Every Day. Lucy's RNZ's executive editor, Lifestyle and Entertainment. Morena.
Morena, Jim.
The last of the summer tomatoes. Although I think you have tomatoes still going at home, don't you?
I do. I'm currently experiencing the first of the summer tomatoes.
How does that work out?
Well, I live in Wellington, as you know, and when we moved into our new house about 3 years ago, my neighbour said to me, conversationally over the fence, that he didn't plant his tomatoes until quite late, until, you know, December or early January. And he said, fantastic thing about them is that when they're fully ripe, it is exactly the same time as when tomatoes are really cheap in the shops. And we had a good old laugh about that. And now I find myself doing exactly the same thing. However, and this is not to, I won't even pretend this is a humble brag, it's just a straight out brag, the homegrown ones taste so much better than the shop ones.
Why is that? I've never worked that out.
It's the tender loving care I give them,
Jim. Of course. And the very special microclimate where you live now.
Yeah, that must be it. Actually, they have thrived on neglect, actually. We had a story on rnz.co.nz earlier in the, either early this year or late last year, with gardener Kath Irvin saying, don't water your tomatoes. And because it's been a drought down here, I've faithfully followed all the rules and Kath's advice and not watered them, and they've been fantastic.
That's your next book title, The Neglected Garden.
Yeah.
What would you do with them for a summer, I'll ask that again. What would you do them, they pay me to broadcast. Yeah. What would you do with them for a Sunday brunch?
For a Sunday brunch? Well, I think really good tomatoes, really good homegrown or exemplary shop-bought ones don't need too much done to them, actually. I think some really fantastic bread with, olive oil or cream cheese or something, or even, you know, hot buttered toast with thickly sliced or squished little tomatoes, with lots of salt and pepper and some basil. You know, I don't think you need to mess around with them too much.
I've always thought you do need salt on a tomato.
Yes, except in a tomato sandwich.
Oh, okay.
Or, no, there'll be a caveat to that, except in a tomato sandwich that you are making in advance, because that makes the tomato watery. And as you know, water is the enemy of a good sandwich. So a soggy tomato sandwich is nobody's friend.
You see all these salads online with tomatoes as the centrepiece. I saw a panzanella salad and a caprese salad, and I have no idea what they are. But you can add lots of things, basically, if you want to.
Yeah. Oh, I make a fantastic salad with tomatoes, little tomatoes, baby cherry tomatoes, and peaches. Peaches are still around.
Ah.
I had a peacherine for my breakfast this morning, and mint and olive oil and sort of a dressing with olive oil and vinegar and halloumi. And that's really good.
A peacherine.
Yeah. Peacherine is the king or queen or reigning monarch of all stone fruit. Apart from the black Doris plum.
How have I lived this long? It's very easy, without knowing that, it's very easy to ruin tomatoes, Lucy, in the oven by blasting them. Well, I'll rephrase that. It's very easy for me to do that. What sort of temperature do you use? Do you know?
Are you talking about sort of a slow roasting of them?
I think so, yes.
I would say probably no hotter than 170. I think if you do it too much hotter than that, then they'll burn rather than concentrate their flavours.
When you bottle them, and I saw someone advocating bottling them with zucchinis for a lovely sort of chutney, is there any way of making the tomatoes still taste a bit like tomato sauce so that when you add the relish, you know, to whatever else you're using to serve to children, they'll think it's kind of quite tomato saucy.
There is no way, I think, that you can make homemade sauce that tastes like one out of a plastic squeezy bottle. And that's the beauty of the homemade sort. My mother used to make this fantastic tomato sauce, which probably was more of a relish, really. It would have defied all conventional sauce or relish making principles, and it was probably a bit runny, and sometimes it was a bit vinegary, but we loved it, and her grandchildren loved it. And when, after my mother died, among the many things I miss about her is that none of us have this tomato sauce recipe.
Oh, I thought you were going about to give it to us.
Oh, I wish I could. And, you know, my nieces, who are all grown up, you know, often send me emails saying, Have you found Grandma's recipe anywhere? You know, do you know anyone who's got it? Can you ask someone else who's got it? And I feel like it's going to be my, you know, my life's work will be trying to find this recipe. I've got all my mother's old recipe books, you know, the handwritten ones or bits cut out from newspapers, and it's never there. And it's not in any of the recipes she got from my great aunt either. And it's very frustrating. It's lost to the mists of time.
People should feel free to send in their own recipes, and
please
I'll pass them on. Hot cross buns. Before I ask you what to do with them, I saw the headline, I think it was on RNZ this week, about adding, was it cheese and onion?
Yes.
When does a hot cross bun become not a hot cross bun, just a bun that will make some people hot and cross?
Yeah, I know that the cheese and onion variation, I think that is a bridge too far. I'm all for experimentation, but I'm actually a bit of a traditionalist when it comes to hot cross buns. I think they have to have a cross on them, they have to have lots of dried fruit, and they have to be well spiced. I saw some recently in the supermarket that were, you know, brioche buns with no fruit, no spice, and no crosses, and I thought, but they were still being billed as marketed as hot cross buns, and I thought something has gone terribly wrong in the world.
Yes, they're not cross buns.
Yeah.
As far as spices go, what would you? I think the original idea was to use spices to represent the spices that were used to embalm Jesus after he died. I don't know if people like to think of that too much at Easter, but what sort of spices would you tend to use, do you think?
I think the traditional ones are cinnamon and ginger and mixed spice. Maybe some allspice. Now, allspice and mixed spice are not the same thing. Allspice is a berry, whereas mixed spice is, you know, the clue is in the name, a mix of spices like cinnamon and ginger and cardamom, I think. Cardamom is really beautiful in a hot cross bun. One tip I would give home hot cross bun makers is not to think, oh, I love cinnamon so much, I'll put in twice as much, because it will retard or slow down the yeast. So if you have too much cinnamon, and your buns might be a bit unrisen.
I read if you bake your hot cross, this is an old superstition, if you bake your hot cross buns on the Friday, they'll keep till next year. And that was an old belief which you would think would have been contradicted by reality fairly early on. But I don't know if it's ever worked. All right, thank you. So that's hot cross buns taken care of and tomatoes. Can I ask you a couple more things?
Oh, of course.
Online, on the Epicurious site, good name, I came across the suggestion that we should cook steaks from frozen for a better result. It gets rid of the grey band around the edge of the steak. And I don't think you're a steak specialist, but am I imagining this? In the old days, a Scotch fillet was a surefire cut. And these days you kind of have to go to an eye fillet, which is really expensive, to avoid the gristle. Or am I just cooking steaks wrongly?
I remember in days of old that, yeah, Scotch fillet was a solid option, because I remember my father, actually, who would have considered himself a steak specialist, would say that, you know, fillet had the best texture, but Scotch had the best flavour.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that kind of tallies with what I think too from the past.
Yeah, anyway, so it must be right.
It's changed. A few more things. Oats, as we know, have made a nutrition comeback for good reasons. What do you think about baking oats or adding them to cups of tea or adding eggs to oats?
Now, the adding them to cups of tea thing, I had to look up when you mentioned that earlier because I thought, this is, you know, this is taking oat milk way too far. What I did discover was people suggesting that you cook your oats, your oatmeal, or your porridge in tea. I'm okay with that idea, I think. I mean, I'm sort of, I won't dismiss it out of hand without trying it, but it sounds a bit odd. Adding eggs to oats, is that to sort of boost the protein content?
I suppose so.
Yeah, I suppose you could. Though, you know, a few years ago, someone said to me that she couldn't eat porridge in the morning because if she had porridge in the morning, she'd be guaranteed to eat like a Labrador for the rest of the day, that porridge didn't fill her up as it was advertised to do. And I remember saying to her, I think what you need to have it with, you know, if you're just having porridge by itself, it's a bit dull. I think if you add in a good amount of fat to it, like a nice slosh of cream, for example, then it tends to make you feel a bit fuller.
Okay.
So
sure
I would
add
cream rather than an egg or a scoop of protein powder or anything like that.
Thank you. On Delish.com, I saw what is purportedly the best way, full stop, to cook rice. Rinse it first, use 2 cups of water for every cup of rice, wait till the water boils, add the rice and salt and butter, bring it to the boil, turn the heat down, simmer for 18 minutes, perfecto. What do you think?
I was interested by this too, because I think from memory that when I first, you know, was living independently and cooking rice, I'm sure that's how we made it in my flat. I'm sure we, you know, rinsed it, boiled it. I don't know that we would have cooked it for 18 minutes exactly, but that's not the way I do it. And I think I can cook rice okay.
Okay. Yeah, there are so many variations on rice cooking. It's just bamboozling, really.
Yeah.
Do you use apple cider vinegar? I mean, aside from its myriad benefits, one study, you know, cautiously, found that when combined with a meal for 3 months, people saw a decent reduction in body fat. Is cider vinegar also making a comeback? You do hear it mentioned more these days.
Oh, yeah, I think it is. I use it in salad dressings. I sometimes have some in hot water. In the summer, when it's hot, if I don't want to drink just plain water, I'll have a teaspoon of apple cider vinegar with some soda water. And it sort of, you know, makes something slightly sour and sparkly, which is quite thirst-quenching.
Yeah.
But I know it's hugely popular. There is a French biochemist, I think she is, called Jessie Enchausby, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who goes by the name of the glucose goddess, and she's all about vinegar and using it to stop your glucose from spiking.
Ah.
Now, that's your blood glucose levels spike after you eat, or particularly after you eat sugar and starchy food.
Yeah.
And she's become massively famous, has this huge social media following, but her detractors say, well, you know, a glucose spike in and of itself isn't a bad thing. I mean, that's just how your body reacts to having, you know, sugary and starchy food.
Mm.
The problem is when that spike doesn't flatten out again afterwards. But her argument is that if you have apple cider vinegar before you're eating any of these things, then it doesn't mean you've got a huge crash, that it sort of evens out the spike into a bit more of a wave or a curve.
Okay. My mum was a great fan of cider vinegar, so old wisdoms persist. Can I ask you about hyper-chopped sandwiches? Hyper-chopped sandwiches have become an exhibition piece on TikTok. Is there any point to hyper-chopping sandwich ingredients?
Oh, well, if you've watched any of the videos on TikTok about hyper-chopped sandwiches, they start to look like they've been pre-masticated.
Yes, I know. It's amazing chopping.
And it is amazing chopping. It's quite fun to watch the chopping until it gets to the stage where it looks like someone's... you know.
We understand.
You know what I'm saying.
Yes.
It did amuse me that, you know, someone, I read somewhere that hyperchop sandwiches had become extremely performative. And I thought, an example of extremely performative food on TikTok. And I thought, isn't that the point? That it's all quite performative. I can see the point of it, in that the argument, I think, is that when you've hyperchopped, then you'll get, in each bite of the sandwich, you're getting a bit of everything. And ingredients are less likely to fall out. Going back to tomatoes, you know that annoying thing if you're biting into a sandwich with slices of tomato in it, and you might bite into one and you drag the tomato out, and then, you know, the rest of your sandwich is tomato free.
In the end, though, you've eaten everything if you don't hyperchop.
Well, yeah. I don't know how you'd go with, people who don't like their foods to be touching each other. They might struggle with the hyper-chopped sandwich.
I think you've hit the nail on the head with the performative aspect. Just finally, I want to ask you about garlic, because I bought some at the supermarket for preserving, and it's imported, and it doesn't taste much like garlic at all, a bit like the tomatoes you were mentioning. How can garlic not taste like garlic? Do you know?
Well, I think it's because imported garlic needs to be, I don't want to say fumigated because I think that's the wrong word, but it needs to be treated in some way so it doesn't bring nasty bugs or organisms into the country. So maybe it's in the way it's dried or treated that maybe it bleaches all the flavour out of it. I'm not sure.
That's interesting.
I'm curious how you were going to preserve it.
Well, there's a variety of methods, and this time I've settled on basically cider vinegar and a bit of sugar for preserving it, and a couple of spices, the names of which I've forgotten because they went, you know, in my head and then out again once I put the packets back. But I've tried a few ways of doing garlic, and I'm not entirely convinced the new way is the best way, but I can always advise you of this point at a later time.
I would love to know, do you preserve it so it's easier to use in cooking later in the year, or do you just preserve it so you can snack on it?
Snack on it and you don't have the bad breath, basically. And it still tastes quite nice. It still tastes, certainly still tastes garlicky, albeit with a more astringent flavour.
Have you tried black garlic?
No, I don't even know what black garlic is.
Black garlic is fantastic. It is aged garlic, I suppose you'd say. So the garlic is harvested and then kept in a sort of controlled environment for a few weeks until it, I want to say, ferments, but that's probably not quite the way to describe it. And the flavour, the flavour is so intense. It's sort of garlicky, licoricey, caramelly.
Oh.
It's really amazing. And the texture, it turns each clove into this little kind of soft, almost like a wine gummy texture. And you can use it as you would use normal garlic. But I've also had it used in sweet preparations. There was a chef a few years ago, I went to this a black garlic event, and he'd made black garlic chocolate mousse. Where the flavour of the black garlic just is this beautiful kind of dark note in the mousse. It's beautiful. It's a great thing to snack on.
Dark note in the mousse. The black garlic chef would be a good name for a chef, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. Yeah, right up there with the neglected garden.
That's your next book. Yeah. Very good. Thank you for joining us and talking about tomatoes and hot cross buns and all that stuff.
You're welcome.
Lucy Corrie.